Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
And a good morning as we make our way well into May. And today is May the 4th. Can we get this out of the way before we even start with The Last Dance or NFL releasing the schedule, any of those things? Chris, can we get the May the 4th be with you right out of the way, right off the top of the show?
Dave, you don't want to embrace Star Wars?
I mean, I'm fine with embracing Star Wars. I think doing it in that way is a little cheesy, no?
May the 4th be with you?
Rick, right, we're done. That's out. We've come out with it.
No, you come out with it. I'm not out with it. I'm not done with it.
So this is going to be a theme for you.
This is going to be a thing for me all day.
All right. Rick, are you in agreement?
I'm going to be company man today.
No, I'll leave it to Canty. I'm excited for Cinco de Mayo / Taco Tuesday. I'll come in tomorrow. I'm all set with May the 4th be with you.
Right.
I'm good.
So tomorrow's your day. Tomorrow's what you got circled on the calendar.
Yeah, tomorrow allegedly there could be margaritas involved with tomorrow's show. I'm just saying.
Why allegedly? Why would you not absolutely? Wait, during the show?
Yeah, allegedly during the show. Who knows? You never know. I could be having a nice coffee. I could be having a delicious margarita. You'll never know.
I think we could know. Yourself.
But let me get this right, guys. You guys, and I'm just being objective here, because Rick, you're used to towing the company line as well. We're doing a show on ESPN Radio. ESPN is owned by ABC, Disney.
Yeah,
they also own Star Wars. Why would we not try to promote it? Why would we not talk about it on May the 4th?
Well, I don't think we need to talk about it. I think as long as one of us. Yeah, I think no, as long I mean, as yeah. one of us talks about it.
Well, I just want to throw a reference in there every now and again.
I got the Bachelor. Like, I'm doing my part.
Okay. So you're going to let me own this one?
I'm American Idol, baby.
All right. I'll own this one then. I'll own this in World News Tonight with David Muir. I got those.
I like David Muir as well. I'd like if we're going to draft here, I'd like to get involved in Jeopardy before you guys snag that off the table.
It's the beauty of having three people on the show. We got everything covered.
There you go. By the way, Rise of Skywalker now officially streaming on Disney Plus as of today.
There you go,
Chris
Dave. There you go.
I can play.
All right. I like it.
I can play.
I like it.
All right. So last night, Last Dance, outstanding as usual. And then they have to go back to 93. And all this, oh, it's such a great program and it's so in depth and I'm learning so much and Michael's so cool. That pained me watching 93. Knicks win the first two games. You have the Starks dunk. Then Jordan goes to Atlantic City. I mean, they make it sound like he goes on a crazy bender, comes back. They don't lose another game to the Knicks. They win it in six. Awful, awful stuff.
Yeah, it was painful.
Awful.
Absolutely painful. It made me miss that kind of basketball, though. I mean, maybe a little bit overly physical, which, okay, I mean, I can understand. But as far as the intensity level, man, I mean, getting each other's faces, and that, again, I mean, was he fouled? Of course he was fouled, but it was the time. I mean, that was.
Who, Charles Smith?
Yeah, he was fouled. Yeah,
of course he was fouled.
Of course he was fouled. But that's, I mean, that's par for the course. That was one of the reasons why the New York Knicks were as good as they were. You know what I mean? They were a physical team. So I get why they didn't call it. But, I mean, seriously, like being in New York, having to watch that again, brutal. Brutal day.
Awful. Awful.
It's on the media, too, by the way. That's on the media.
100%.
Just let Jordan go gamble. Who cares? We don't have to bring it up. Do what he wants. Let him go to AC. You know what I mean? Like, you went about this the opposite. You should be doing what Lawrence Taylor's doing. Be sending things to his room. Keep him out all night. Make a big deal out of it. Come on. He doesn't need to be incentivized.
Yeah, the comments of a certain radio host at another station didn't age well when you looked at that docuseries last night. It just didn't. But they poked the sleeping bear, man. I mean, Michael Jordan, after going down 0-2, and then that story about him going to AC between games 1 and 2 came out, and you knew that in game 3 he was going to have something to prove. He was going to have his response. He said it in the episode last night. He let his game do his talking for him. And, you know, based on what happened in game 3, there was no doubt about how that series was going to end up.
I can't believe he missed five. What, he missed five layups? I mean, he had five chances in low. Do you remember when we were at the Meadowlands and we did the show the first day or the second day, the Friday of March Madness, and we had Charles Smith sit with us?
Yeah, I do. I remember that. Yeah.
It took me every ounce of my being not just to be like, you couldn't have put the ball, you couldn't have just laid it in five chances.
He was trying. It wasn't like
he wasn't trying. God's sakes. I mean, that could have changed the entire complexion of the NBA if he would have hit one of those two shots, three shots, four shots, five shots. Just make one.
Yeah, but that's how many times have we spent here, talking about Eli's career, talking about Chris's championship, talking about, you know, the 2007 championship. All the little plays. I mean, now Asante Samuel wants to talk about how it's no fun. Well, it would have been more fun if maybe you caught that ball and it intercepted it, so you would have went 19-0, dummy. Keep your mouth shut. But, during the course of these runs, man, there's all these little moments, little plays that could have been the difference.
Yeah, you got to have breaks in the game go your way. But like Charles Barkley said last night, and talking about that 93 finals, when you have Michael Jordan on the court, all the breaks are going to go in that team's favor. Charles Barkley said it. He said it was the first time in his basketball career where he felt like even if he played his best, there was somebody on the court that was better than him. And that was true when you're looking at the guy everybody called after that Dream Team experience the best basketball player in the world. They referred to him as being the all-star among all-stars. That's how big Michael Jordan was. It was unanimous after that practice in Barcelona for the Dream Team that he was the best player in the NBA. That was clear. And I think that was probably one of the first times in the league's history where you had a consensus like this is the best player in the game. And it's really not a question when you ask the other guys that are the top all-stars.
That was actually one of my favorite parts about last night when Magic Johnson threw the ball into the stands.
I love that. I love the video of that, by the way. How great. You have the best 12. It's funny that they always say also we have the best 11 basketball players in the world. They won't include Christian Laettner in that list. But, to watch video of games between the greatest in a little gym over in Monte Carlo, some of the footage is remarkable in the series.
Yeah, that's what makes the series so good, man. You've heard all the stories about it. They get a chance to see it. And the trash talking going back and forth, talking about the ticky-tack fouls. What was funny, too, was when they were posing, when it was Michael, Larry, and Magic posing for that picture. And then he's like, you can't get too close to Michael.
That's otherwise,
you call for a foul.
Yeah. It was great. Foul, yep.
But getting back to that Knicks point, too, though, Dave, when you look at that game three, the Knicks win the first two in New York. Go back game three. Mm-hmm. Jordan was 3 for 18 in that game three. He only had 22 points. He got most of his points on the free throw line. So, you could look at that moment too. You lost the game where Jordan
you had opportunities.
Went for 22.
You had opportunities. You're up 2-0. If you steal one of the two in Chicago, odds are you're going to win that series. Then all you had to do after you're tied at two is just hold serve, win games 5 and 7. And you couldn't do it. But something was said last night. Jordan said it. And he said, look, that Knicks team was good. But if you compare our team, and this is painful for me to say, Chris, but if you compare our team to their team, meaning the Bulls to the Knicks, we're just better. I think that's true. I think the Bulls were, and it's taken me a long time to get to this point, but I think the Bulls are just a better basketball team than the Knicks were.
No, the Bulls were a better basketball team, Dave, but there's also, I guess, you have a contrast in styles. Because the Knicks were one of those traditionally built teams. We're going to focus our offense around the big man, and we're going to play a physical brand of basketball, and we're just going to be tougher than you. Whereas with the Jordan teams, I'm not going to say that they weren't physical or they weren't tough, but it was led by a guy that had the ball in his hands more often than not in Michael Jordan. And when you realize his ability to be able to impact the game on the offensive end to set the tone, I think that gives you a slight advantage. And it was really at that point, you would say that, teams stopped being focused on being built around centers, and the focus ultimately shifted to being built around guys that could score, guys that could have the ball in their hands at all times. And I think that, like Michael Jordan showed you, in the first couple of episodes of this series, and even again last night, when he has the ball in his hands in the game on the line, your team is in a pretty good spot. And that's exactly what happened, even though they were down 0-2. In that Eastern Conference Finals, it was a situation where there was no doubt that Jordan was going to be able to come back. He was going to be able to find a way to win. Even if he wasn't being able to play his best, he could dictate the terms of the game. And that's what they said. Steve Kerr talked about it. He said, Michael Jordan was playing a different game than everybody else just because he could control the tempo of the game. And I think that that's something that we see even in today's NBA. But I think that style started when you had the emergence of Michael Jordan in the early 90s.
I think, too, what you got to recognize at that point in Jordan's career and that Bulls team, they already had played the best version of the New York Knicks and got over that hurdle, which was the Detroit Pistons. You know what I mean? Like, you could always rely on that experience. Like, a team that tried to play you that tough, I mean, the best version of that team was the Pistons, and you got past that. So you could always lean on that as your previous experience, how to, you know, how to get through that.
But the Knicks were a good basketball team. I mean, you just look back with Ewing and Oakley and Mason and Starks. I mean, that was a good basketball team. But
yeah, it was a good basketball team, but it wasn't the Pistons. I mean, they already had beat. I mean, the best version of that was that Detroit Pistons team.
Yeah, the better version was the Pistons. But the Knicks were tough. They were so tough.
Yeah, that's fine. But they're not going to be. I mean, it wasn't going to be for Michael Jordan and that Bulls team. It wasn't going to be tougher than trying to beat the Pistons. They already done it. I mean, that's why I think he felt comfortable saying that. I mean, if both teams played their best, we were better.
That's true.
Because in his mind, they already had
their best. They were better.
Yeah. So, I mean, during the course of a playoff series, to have that kind of confidence, because you've already been there and you've done that, as opposed to, you know, a Knicks team that hadn't. You know what I'm saying? That's important when you're trying to, you know, win a seven-game series, to have that to lean back on.
You know, the Knicks went to the playoffs every single season in the 1990s.
Why do you need to bring that up?
I'm just bringing up positive memories.
To just frustrate everybody?
Every single season in the 1990s. Those are nice memories, no?
Yeah, those are nice memories. I mean, I would like them back. I mean, it's been far too long.
So here's a question for you. Let's, argument's sake, Knicks get by the Bulls. You think they would have beaten the Suns?
Knicks get by the Bulls. Do they beat the Suns?
Suns were good.
Level of confidence? Yeah, probably. I just think the amount of momentum, the amount of confidence you would have leading into that series, it would almost remind you of when, you know, Jordan finally got through the Pistons. And then once they got through the Pistons, it was a wrap.
Right.
And the finals was a no big deal. Would have been a tough series.
Very.
But, I mean, let's just, for the sake of us feeling better, let's pretend like if they did get past the Bulls,
yes, they would. Yes, absolutely they would have gotten by the Suns.
How ridiculous is it, though? Well, what are we doing? Why would we focus on it being a negative that Jordan went to AC? Like, I'd have been like, oh, that's great. I hope he continues to go to the casino. Maybe we should, you know, send a helicopter so we can get to AC, you know, quicker when he comes back. Why is the New York media criticizing him? Give him, like, are you going to give this guy motivation?
Because that's what you do. He's the biggest star in the world. And if you know he's in Atlantic City at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's certainly going to be front page, back page news.
Yeah, I guess. I think I would have tried to spin it in the opposite direction. I mean, you're talking about a guy who never met Tony Kukoc in his life and just decided that because Jerry Krause thought he was the future of the Chicago Bulls, that they were just gonna make his life miserable.
They were really unfair to him, by the way. Really unfair to him.
I heard the best I've heard it said was Mike Wilbon. Jerry Krause didn't play, so they couldn't beat up on him. So the next best thing was to take it out on Tony
Kukoc.
Beat
up on all his guys.
Exactly right. Which I kind of respect in a little way, to be honest.
Yeah. No, it's true. But, I mean, here's a guy who you didn't even meet him. You didn't even know him. He's going
to
be your teammate.
Yeah, but you don't need to know him. All you need to know is that your general manager thinks that he's a heck of a basketball player, and they used a draft pick on him in the middle of their dynastic run.
And he was.
Yeah, I'm not saying that he wasn't a good basketball player, Dave, but in terms of what Jerry Krause was saying about him and how he viewed him, going as far as to say this dude is the future of the Chicago Bulls, I'm sure Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen felt away. And they went out there and they took it out on him. Now, you cannot like it. You can say they're unfair to him, but I mean, players feel away about the general manager because general managers in sports typically tell you their responsibility is to try to find somebody that's better than you that's also cheaper. Somebody that can replace you. And for Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, they felt like their general manager didn't recognize their true value. So
yeah,
the way he put it was he
wasn't taking care of his own kids. Because that was the whole Pippen thing and the money, you know what I'm saying? So I got to understand why they felt the way about it. How about when Krause asked Jordan for a cigar? Jordan goes, no, it'll stunt your growth.
they were so nasty to him. But he was so good. Like, one of the things, and there's a lot of little nuanced things in this documentary, but we don't give credit to Jerry Krause. He drafted Kukoc in the second round. He was over there scouting him, and I don't know how commonplace that was back in the day. Like, this guy he brought in Grant. They brought in Rodman. I mean, you look at the shooters that they brought in to surround this team. Jerry Krause was a terrific general manager that I think we lose sight of because Michael and Scottie were just so good around him.
Well, I mean, we're saying he's a terrific general manager because he found the complementary pieces to go along with the superstar, which is Michael Jordan. If you don't have Michael Jordan, then nobody's talking about how good of an executive Jerry Krause is.
Okay, Jerry Krause didn't find Michael Jordan. If you don't trade for Pippen and draft Kukoc,
I'm not saying that those moves weren't necessary in order to win a championship, but the most important part of the dynastic run was Michael Jordan.
Of course.
That was it. So Michael Jordan wanted that respect from the general manager, but you got the general manager going on record and saying players are nice, but it's organizations that win championships. And he keeps doubling down on that statement when Michael Jordan has been the biggest agent of change for the Chicago Bulls team. That's the part of it where Jordan and Pippen had trouble reconciling. They couldn't square that circle. And it still doesn't make sense when you hear how adamant Jerry Krause is about how important it is for the organization, about how important it is to have the infrastructure in place. That's all great. I'm not saying that those things did not play a role in being able to have sustained success, but the most important part of it was Michael Jordan, and Jordan didn't feel like he was getting that respect from the GM. Now, whether that's real or not, we'll never know. But from Jerry Krause's commentary, you could understand why there would be some friction in that relationship.
I would actually love to hear from Jerry Krause. Unfortunately, obviously, he's unable to, I mean, God rest his soul. But, I mean, I wonder how much of that, you know, knowing who Michael Jordan was, what motivated Michael Jordan. I mean, and part of that, you know, last night, too,
was tweaking him.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, Jerry Krause liked Dan Marley. And how did that work out for Dan Marley? I mean, you're still talking about, you know, firing Doug Collins, right, and bringing in Phil Jackson, which mm-hmm. turned out to be a great move. You know, moving on from Charles Oakley, who was, you know, Michael Jordan's closest friend on the team. Like, I mean, he did... I mean, maybe he stepped too far over the line as far as, you know, his ego was concerned. But, you know, let's face it, man. Sometimes great players don't necessarily know what's in their best interest all the time. And it's up to the people making the decisions to kind of, you know, make some tough moves that end up working out. But, I could make an argument for Dave in this case, and I could make an argument for Chris in this case. But, I mean, I think my biggest takeaway is Jerry Krause was really good at what he did and was responsible for those championships. Not as much as the players, obviously, because they play, but no. I mean, he made some unbelievable moves.
I mean, he traded for Pippen, the kid from Central Arkansas. He traded for him. He got Rodman. He got Grant. Like, you look at the pieces. Kukoc was a second-round selection. It's almost a throwaway pick at this point now in the NBA. And I'm not saying that Jordan wasn't the number one factor. Of course he was. You're not winning anything without him. But the team that Jerry Krause put around him, surrounded him with, was a hell of a basketball team.
No, it was a hell of a basketball team. And you know what? It's like one of those things that we think about is, okay, what motivated these guys to have that level of success? Who's to say that Jerry Krause, because he had that type of mentality, wasn't a part of the chip that Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and the rest of the Bulls put on their shoulder in order to go out there and create this Bulls dynasty? Like, I mean, that has to be a part of the conversation as well. Now, whether he intended to do that or not, the motivation was real. And it ended up working out to everybody's benefit because they did something, well, Michael Jordan did something that his contemporaries never did. Like, I mean, you start talking about the players that were the best in the game when Michael Jordan came into the league. Larry Bird, Isaiah Thomas, Magic Johnson. None of those guys won three straight championships. None of them. Michael Jordan was able to pull that off. And I think that's something that says something that he felt like separated him from those other guys.
I don't think it's much different. I mean, I guess it's a little different because, you know, you're talking about a guy who's the GM and the coach. But, I mean, it is, you know, similar in certain regards to, you know, how Bill Belichick runs things with the Patriots. You know, never really given, you know, Tom Brady the credit that Tom Brady felt like he deserved. Maybe that's part of, like, you know, the mind games of pushing Tom Brady to... Mm-hmm. You know, to where he's at now. I mean, getting rid of players a year early. I mean, making some moves, Lawyer Malloy. I mean, you name it. I mean, that cutthroat aspect.
Right. They moved on from Doug Collins when he went to after he went to a conference championship.
Yeah. I mean, those are tough moves. I mean, and again, who knows the psychology of it? Because I think that's a big part of it. I think that's what made Phil Jackson so great, too, was the psychology. Did you notice the one thing that I thought was interesting last night? And maybe I'm watching it too closely. They showed Jerry Krause in his office, and he's got the Inspector Gadget, you know, the Inspector Gadget stuffed Bennington Bear in his office.
No.
in the corner. I was like, what? What is that? Why does he have a stuffed bear in his office?
No,
I think I'm watching it too closely.
800-919-3776. People all lined up, want to talk about The Last Dance. Let's do it with them. 800-919-3776. Spike in Jersey. Spike, lead us off on a Monday. You're first up on 98.7.
Good morning, my friends. I hope you all had a nice weekend on this beautiful weekend. And then it ended with this garbage I had to revisit. I was
you didn't enjoy this either last night, did you, Spike?
No. We talked about this Saturday, the disdain for the Bulls. I will call it a draw. Here's what happened. In those days, we had a season ticket plan. Three buddies and myself, we always split the parking. We parked right across the street. We got there early. We grabbed the same thing, burger and fries, and we walked up, and we were psyched. And we run into Hugh Hollins, who was refereeing that game. I forget the other two officials. So, of course, my big trap, I said, call it tight tonight, yo. You know, and if you look at that box score, I'm sure you guys can pull it up. The Knicks, I believe, missed 15 free throws that night. So put the Charles Smith misses into perspective. 15 free throws they missed. Tastes close to me. You can't miss that many free throws. And if you look at Jordan, had a triple-double in that game. No one ever talks about it. They didn't have so many of them. But that, everything came up. I had a nice meal. My wife last night was beautiful. We were eating a nice, beautiful meal. And I got to watch that garbage again. It's just, it's so bad. It was so bad. But I will take some of the onus off of Charles Smith. They're not calling that foul. They're just not calling it, guys. And I believe the Chicago bench didn't even score in that game. Well, maybe had a couple of points. It was just the epitome of being a Knicks fan all my life. That's the worst memory. Even Game 7 in Houston wasn't as bad because Game 6 was so good. It was the three-day wait in between. So you're right, Dave. You hate this guy as much as anybody, but it's a dead heat with me and you. And he's a great player. He's so smooth.
And nobody ever denied that. No, and thanks for the call, Spike. Nobody ever denied that. Jordan in that game did. You know how many assists he had in that game? Chris, take a guess. How many assists he had in that game?
I'm going to say he had 13 assists.
14 assists.
29
points, 14 assists, 10 rebounds. That's unbelievable. Played 45 minutes in that game.
I mean, Dave, you're talking about somebody that could impact the game in almost every single way, whether you want to talk about scoring, whether you want to think about facilitating, being a playmaker, whether it's on the defensive end. I mean, it's nothing that Michael Jordan didn't have in his arsenal. Like, this is a complete basketball player. And on top of that, he might be the most motivated guy every time he steps foot on the court.
Which is awesome, which I do love. I love when he's shooting quarters with that security guard at Chicago Stadium.
The albino pimp?
The Stan Albeck of security guards. Yeah.
He looks like Chris Broussard with a perm.
That was some hairdo, huh?
No, you know my favorite part is that too, is when Jordan goes, okay, I'll give you four to my one, and then on the first toss he wins it, and then Jordan's all pissed off. He's like,
yeah, he's like, well, it rolled.
Yeah, and he's like, well, your money's gonna roll into my pocket.
That guy was funny.
I love that guy.
But it just shows you. And they even asked him, like, do you have a gambling problem? He's like, I don't have a gambling problem, and that could be debated certainly. He's like, I have a competition problem. And I love it. I love the fact that everything he does, everything he has to do, everything that he's ever done is I'm going to win or I'm going to lose, and it's all about competition. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. But, I mean, you can see, I mean, mentally how that would wear on you, though. You know what I'm saying?
Of course.
Like, if you lived every single day of your life like that, where everything had to be a competition.
Everything. Everything. And then they showed you kind of some of the intricacies into his life. It's like, and I know you guys have dealt with it to a certain extent, but, I mean, you can't even be yourself. Like, once you, and they showed it, once you leave your hotel room, you are now, like, everything is critique. You're mobbed. You have people that just want to be near you and literally touch you and have you speak to them and their kids. And it's unbelievable to think you could have any semblance of a normal life. And he probably couldn't with that level of fame.
It would have been a lot worse had you had social media.
Much.
But, I mean, you know, Michael Jordan was larger than life, man. I mean, he created this figure and then had the ability through his play to live up to it. And so, yeah, it's one of those things where you're like, most guys, they can talk the talk, but they can't walk the walk. No, Michael Jordan could talk the talk, and then he could actually go out there and play the game better than anybody else on the planet. Like, that's what made him special, man. And he told you he was focused on basketball. That was the only thing that he was locked in on. Single-mindedness. It wasn't about anything else. He was focused on being the very best basketball player that he could be. And that's, it wasn't about anything else for him. He said it. I could average 2 points and three rebounds and nobody would care about who Michael Jordan is. But it's because of my play that everybody else is interested. Because of my play, I have all of these opportunities outside of basketball. So he never lost sight of that. And that's hard to do, especially when you're at the top, Dave.
Yeah, that's one of the hardest things, too, to tell young players, right, is, I mean, especially now with social media and everything else, everyone concerned about their brand, is that, you know, his mindset was, my success on the court, winning championships, that'll build the brand. I don't need to go out of my way to build it. Like, all those opportunities will come because I'm great at what I do. And by the way, I mean, shame on Adidas. You can't find a way to get a sneaker made for Michael Jordan.
Or Converse.
Converse.
They want him to be the face of the sneaker department.
But Dolores Jordan really founded Nike, huh?
Oh, my goodness, right?
she was the real mastermind behind it.
Yeah, you're going to at least take the meeting. He didn't even want to take the meeting, he said, with Nike.
Well, it's because he liked Adidas at the time, Dave. I mean, he didn't want to do that. Nike was thought of as, what, a track shoe company?
Yeah.
But, I mean, listen, it was revolutionary in the way that they branded him, and I guess that goes along with what his agent, David Falk, was trying to sell him on, you know, being the first athlete in a team sport to be branded like an athlete in an individual sport. I think they talked about Arthur Ashe last night having a signature shoe and a racket. Mm-hmm. And they were saying that we want to try to brand Michael Jordan in that way. It's just that the shoe companies of the day, that being Converse and Adidas, they didn't feel like they could fit him into their strategy in terms of the NBA guys that they would have. And Nike was like, listen, we'll give you a $250,000 sneaker deal, which was huge for a rookie. And they ended up getting paid back by that, I don't know how many times over, based on how that shoe did in his rookie season. I think they said they projected that they would make $3 million on his shoe in his first year, and it went over $100 million.
Yeah, I think they said that he was going to make over $3 million by his third or fourth year.
Oh, yeah, something like that, yeah.
They played it out, and they said he made $123 million on the shoe in year one. So it really is unbelievable. I don't know if you guys saw this really sad news from the world of football. Don Shula has passed away. Of course, the longtime Dolphins and Colts head coach at the age of 90 years old. The Dolphins put out a statement on Coach Shula. Don Shula was the patriarch of the Miami Dolphins for 50 years. He brought the winning edge to our franchise and put the Dolphins in the city of Miami in the national sports scene. Our deepest thoughts and prayers go out to Marianne along with his children, Dave, Donna, Sharon, and Mike. So, I mean, when you think of the NFL guys right off the bat, I mean, you think of old-time coaches. You think of Lombardi. You think of Landry. Don Shula, granted, came more recently as well, but absolutely one of those guys.
Well, he's the winningest coach of all time, Dave.
Yeah.
That's all you have to say. Who has the most wins as a head coach in the National Football League? It's Don Shula. And I think he's better than Bill Belichick by over 40 games. Like, that's how great he was as a coach. And I mean, listen, you're talking about that undefeated Miami Dolphins team. I mean, that's still the standard. Like, that's still the team. Like, they are the only team to never lose a game in an NFL season in the modern era. So, I mean, I don't know if you can assign enough, you know, adjectives, superlatives, whatever you want to say about how great Don Shula was, but he was certainly one of the revolutionary minds in our game. He changed the way that football is played. And you see elements of that even in today's game.
Yeah. I mean, and he changed it with the way that they used Dan Marino. Remember, passing was never such a key cog to the game of football. Dan Marino comes up in 1984, and all of a sudden, he's thrown for 5,000 yards in a season, which is completely unprecedented. So obviously, the passing of Don Shula, 90 years old, earlier today, and thought it'd be a good idea to kind of reflect and reminisce, and who better to do that with than longtime Dolphins tight ends coach, special teams coach, and friend of our station and our program, Mike Westhoff. Good morning, Mike. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine, guys. Thank you. How are you guys doing?
We're doing the best we can. We're all locked away and trying to produce the best radio we can in a non-sports world. So
I'm doing the same thing.
Yeah, we all are just kind of keeping our head above water best as possible. So. You know, give us some insight. I mean, you coached with Coach Shula for a long time. Give us some insight into what he was like, into the kind of coach he was, and who maybe you'd even compare him to in this generation of coaches that people kind of relate him to.
I'm not going to compare him to anyone in this generation. I'm sorry. I'm just not. I mean, the game was different back then when I entered in 1982. And then I got a call from Don Shula in the, well, I guess it was 85, to come down to Miami. And I spent all this time. I mean, that was like getting a call. If you were a priest, that'd be like when the Pope called you. And it was the same thing. I was so proud of it. He ran. He, in a lot of ways, you could almost say like he was the NFL. I mean, he was a permanent member of the competition committee. Was involved in every legal aspect, the rules, financial dealings. I mean, to me, he was like the head of the officials, the commissioner, and the head coach of the entire league. That's just how he had a role in every aspect of it, and he was very involved. I always use the example, and I felt like in my business, the business I was in for 32 years, he was first. And nobody was second. That's just how I feel. Because he did so many things as a coach that so many other coaches don't do. I mean, he could coach every position. And he ran the draft. He could coach special teams. You know, I think I ended up becoming a pretty good one doing that. And a lot of it, I learned so much from him. Now, I took it and expanded it, which you had to do. But he studied everything. People don't know this. You know, we had a brilliant offense. I mean, he's one of those innovators. You know, when he was back with the Baltimore Colts, they had the great running game. And then when he was at Miami with Larry Zonka and Jim Kick, and then all of a sudden Dan Marino. But he was the offensive coordinator. He called the plays from the sideline with no script. He called them from his head. Now, he had a script stuck in his back pocket. And he pulled up, and Don Strzok helped him, yes, of course. But Don did all that. I mean, he would draw. He could get on the board and draw anything. And so when you coached for him, you really learned. You learned a great deal because, in fact, he made you learn. You know, you had to – all the rules, everything, you had to know the rules, how it was taught. He managed the game, clock management, timeout, substitutions. He was outstanding at all of it. But the thing that I learned from him – is that he never stopped working. There was always, I remember we were in a draft meeting one time, and we had finished up the night before the draft, and one of our scouts, a veteran scout, and he said to Don, he said, are we ready? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah, Coach, the hay's in the barn. Oh, he should have jumped off the bridge rather than said that. Coach Shula, he gave him such a lecture, the hay's never in the barn. And he said, every single second, he wanted to study and to keep learning and, it was really an interesting – it was not easy to work for him back then. It was tough. I mean, he made you earn everything. But once you did and you established yourself, which I did with him, then he was tremendous to me, just tremendous to me. He was like a second father to me.
Wesley, that's the question I wanted to ask you. I mean, you just mentioned what made him a great coach and all the preparation and everything else. I mean, what was he like as a guy? Like, as far as, you know, your personal relationship with him?
Well, he was great to me. He was always he would always ask me things, but he was never asking you. He was, you know, I'd be going with him, and he'd say, like, Mike, you're going to get a car, right? In other words, Mike, get the damn car because I'm driving with you. That's what he was saying. We would go on the road, and we'd have a meeting. Well, I remember in a playoff game one year, we were in a hotel, we were on the road. We walked into this room we had, and everybody, he wanted to make sure you sat at a certain seat. And I sat at the head of the table opposite him, always. And someone was sitting in that seat. And he looked at me and went, what the hell are you doing there? poor guy. You know, I had to jump out of the seat, and he was in my seat. And it's just the way he was. You know, he'd say to me, Mike, you're going to take the second bus, right? In other words, Mike, get your ass on the second bus, because that's where I'm going. You know, that's just the way. But, you know, he just did so many good things. He was a man's man. But the thing I always learned and liked more about him and respected is, as tough as he could be, and trust me, believe me, he could be a tough guy, he was so fair. He was very fair. He was fair with the players. He was fair with the coaches. You know, I've worked for some coaches, and actually I'm going to talk about this a little bit. I'm writing a book right now, which I'm going to expect all you guys to read and help me out. But it's going to be pretty cool because I'm putting a lot into it. I'm really enjoying it. But one of the things that with Coach Shula that you learned, that I learned, was just the way he was so fair in how he treated people. And he was always one to not just going to come in and fire somebody,
But he would figure out how to solve the problem. I mean, he lets you know what the problem was and how we could handle it. Now, you damn sure better do it. You better do it or you're in trouble. But that's the way he did it. It wasn't like he fired a million coaches or things like that. That wasn't him. But trust me, you know, when he came walking down the hall, you know, you'd want to get under your desk and hide like George Costanza did back those old Seinfeld shows. You know, you'd just want to hide under there when he was coming looking for you because you knew you were in trouble. But I had a chair in my office, this big, easy chair, that only I would only let him sit in it. And he'd come in every Wednesday at exactly 6:30. He'd walk in my office. And he'd say, okay. Now, he would let me pretty much do everything. We'd go over the depth chart, and he let me coach everything except one thing he loved, and that was how to punt blocks. And he'd walk in, I'd have stuff drawn. He'd sit in that chair, and he'd turn around and say, okay, what do we got? And we'd start, on football. And I learned all the little basis of how to do every little thing from step by step by step. And I think it's one of the reasons why, I don't know, I think maybe I blocked more than anybody in NFL history, but that's where I learned it from. And I learned it from that, the way he did it. And I never let anyone sit in that chair. And I'll never forget after he retired, and he did not want to come by the offices. He did not have the best relationship with Jimmy Johnson and those new guys. And he used to call me and he'd say, would you tell the rest of those guys I don't work there anymore? Quit talking about what I'm doing. Anyway, he came by and he'd sit down in that chair and he'd spin around and he'd say, okay, what do we got? And he's already retired. I was with the Jets. We blocked the punt on a Monday night. I got a call on a Tuesday night from Don Shula. He said, how'd you do it? What'd you do? He said, I saw it on TV. Break it down. And I would draw it up on a damn board. And I'm in New York and he's in Miami. He was that brilliant of a coach that he could take anything and dissect it. And as a guy, you know, once you kind of earned your stripes with him, and trust me, I'm gonna write a lot about that in the book because I've got incredible stories to tell about it. And people will not know. There's a couple that are just going to knock people out because it's just really something special. But he was so fair as a person. And he saw so many different things and different ways to do it. And he would always hear you out. He would always say, okay. And his big thing was he'd look at you and say, it's hard not to know, but you damn sure better find out. And I did my whole career faced with that. So,
Westy, I know the biggest part of Don Shula's legacy will be the relationships that he had with the players, the coaches, the men that he's worked with, and how he's impacted their lives. But I want to ask you about how Don Shula impacted the way the game was played. I mean, before him, I mean, the NFL was in large part four yards in a cloud of dust with the running game. But, I mean, he was really one of the first people to embrace throwing the ball around the yard, you know, being one of these high-powered offenses. I mean, it was really him, and I guess you would say Don Coryell, Eric Coryell. But, I mean, can you talk about how you see the influence of Don Shula in today's game?
Sure. Don Shula was big at trying to improve anything, any part. He would take it, he would break it down, and he would study what other people did. You know, I mean, he wasn't going to let Bill Walsh get up on him. He would study it. He would take a look, and he'd make sure there was always the door was closed. May was never in the barn with Coach Shula. He always wanted, and he wasn't afraid to try anything. He knew he had, you know, we had Dan Marino, and we could do anything we wanted with such an incredible worker. And so, you know, he wanted to make sure of how do we do these things. You know, I remember when we played the Bears that year, the great 85 Bears, and we beat them on that Monday night. You know, he came in and figure out that, you know, we could put Nat Moore in the backfield. And now they had to cover him from the line of scrimmage. They had no chance. They couldn't do it. He was smart enough to constantly work to try to see if you could do something better. And if you disagreed with them, it's okay, but you better prove your point. I remember getting up on that board. I'm going to tell you, my heart was beating right through my chest. But all of a sudden, there he's sitting down. Well, show me what you want to do here. Oh, I might have a heart attack. But it's how you learn. But the point was, he never, ever, ever said it was okay. Let's always see if we can't do it a little bit better. Whether it was to run, to play any part of the game, he was just such a student of the game. That's why I've referred to him a million times. I mean, I think he's first and nobody second. That's just how I feel, and I will never get away from that because he saw all aspects of it. He was always, if you should have heard his conversations, with the head of officiating. I can't think of his name right now. I'm trying to tip my tongue. Anyway, my goodness gracious. It would be tough. It would be hard. It would be hard to deal with because he was such an expert on everything. Officiating, the way the league was handled. But the point is, with someone like Don Shula, nothing was ever at rest. He was always trying to find a better way and to figure it out. It's the thing I respected about him the most because it was never a status. And that's why you asked, Holly, wasn't afraid, the 3 yards in a cloud of dust. Art McNally, when he would talk to poor Art, oh, my God, because he was tough. But he was smart, and he was fair. He was fair. And it's just the way he did things. But always, always, always accepted the challenge of there's a better way to do it. And if someone else was doing it better, that's okay. But believe me, he was going to figure it out. He was going to find out. And that we that worked for him, we're always under that. And I think it's what really helped me in my career because I never stopped trying to do something different. And I think it's the thing that I did exceptionally well, and I got it right sitting right there with him every single second.
Mike Westhoff with us here, 98.7 ESPN. So I watched a lot of these documentaries, and there was one on Nick Bonacani and one on Larry Zonkin. And just the reverence, Coach, that they speak of when they talk about Don Shula. Players that, played for him years and years and years ago still hold him in this unbelievable high regard. I mean, it felt like, and maybe I'm wrong, that the guys just absolutely adored playing for him. And even when they were done playing in the game, that never ceased.
Well, one of the parts adored would be an interesting way of saying it, because trust me, when you walk off the practice field, a lot of times those guys, it wasn't that they adored him then. Mm-hmm. And they were ready to kill him. They were mad. He was tough. But he was always so fair, and they always saw the result of what he was trying to do. Always, you could always see that. I'll never forget one of the first things he told me was that we were looking at, I was going to warm up and practice the warm up, and how we were, pre-practice and drills and blocking sleds and all that type of thing. And he made it very clear to me. He said, "Don't ever let me see you doing a mindless drill. Ever." I had to coach the offensive line for him for a long time. Our offensive line coach was ill, and I took over at times and did it. And I would be, guys were going to block the seven-man sled. Now, I couldn't say, okay, let's go right shoulder. No, I had to call a play in which they knew then what shoulder to block with. It was never a mindless drill. Not one thing ever, ever, ever. Like, I was not a big drill guy. Even in the line with the Saints a couple years ago. They were talking about we're going to do some drills. I said, no, not with me. I don't do any of that. All I know is we went from 31st to first, so I know it works, and that's where I got it from. From his attention to detail, and the players knew that. Plus, he treated them fairly, and he treated them like men. That's why they respected him. Believe me, he could be hard. Oh, he could be tough. His practices were really difficult, although I think people could learn, because his training camp practices were as tough as you could ever be a part of. Never on the field more than an hour and 25 minutes. Never. But that 25 minutes, whoa, you better muster every stuff that you had, because it was tough. But he just understood that. And at the end of the day, to answer your question, all of those guys knew that everything he did was in benefit of that football team winning and them improving. He relished their successes. He really relished it, and he was exceptional at that. And I think until forever, people appreciate that. I know it's what I gained from him all those years, and I feel so grateful that I had that tremendous time with him, both on the field and off the field, and it's something that will hold an incredible place in my life.
Wes, the last one for me. I kind of want to ask you how fishing's going, but I'll keep this related to the topic that we're, the way you describe him and your relationship, and it's one thing that, I feel like a lot of coaches miss out on or don't, put enough emphasis on. It sounds like that Don Shula made it a point to really get to know each one of his individual players and kind of create that bond, create that trust that everything he was, everything he was preaching, everything he was doing was in their best interest, opposed to kind of, it's my way of doing things, it's my system, and overlook that, you know, that relationship that the greats have with their players.
Well, I think the fact that you could see that he wasn't afraid to change. I mean, he could change something instantly. And he could go from being a running team, just to, you know, with Larry Zonka and Jim kicking to blast the ball in there, to all of, and then to a team that went to the Super Bowl without a, you know, a veteran quarterback. All of a sudden, here comes Dan Marino. You know, and all of a sudden, we're throwing the ball better than anyone.
We had this news, I think it was on Friday, from New York, and now we have it from New Jersey. All New Jersey schools will remain closed for in-person instruction for the remainder of the school year. That comes from Governor Murphy, who's now like a dear friend of the K Show. He's on all the time on the Michael K Show here on 98.7 ESPN. So it's probably the right thing to do to shut these schools down. But speaking of shutting schools down and LIU and launching new teams and all that good stuff, let's bring him in, the AD of LIU, and that's Dr. William Martinoff Jr. joins us here. Dr. Martinoff, we appreciate a couple minutes on 98.7.
Oh, well, hey, thanks. It's great to be on with you guys. It's an honor and a privilege, and we're just excited about what's going on with our athletic program. So I hope I can share some continued great news with all of you.
Absolutely. We certainly want to get in deep detail, and we have a very high-ranking candidate for the head coaching job of the newly formed hockey team. But before we go there with you, I just wanted to ask you, so you're an AD of a school that has a ton of different athletics. How difficult, what has this time been like where everything is just shut down and you have to work remotely and handle everything from I would imagine, home?
Yeah, definitely a different time and different work routine. You know, our coaches and staff, we're used to being around our student athletes. We're used to being out on the fields and, you know, working with them on practices and games. And so those elements are clearly not what we do now, but we're looking forward to getting back to that. I'd say pretty much like everybody else, the technology of Zoom and Skype business and texting and calls are more of the way of the world. And so we're doing the best we can with that. And I think our coaches and our student athletes, we're keeping everybody informed and engaged and looking forward and moving forward. And I think that's the key that we all try to remind ourselves, is that we got to keep moving forward the best we can.
How hard was it for you? I mean, before we get into the announcement, but how hard was it for you having to deal with, you know, the spring sports and the cancellation of spring sports with your seniors?
You know, I think it's tough, you know, for everybody, seniors particularly, because of their opportunities and what the future may hold for them. You know, it's tough. We've stayed in touch with our student athletes and reminded them how much we care about them and how much we're looking to come up with some solutions for the future. And, you know, as well as all the way down to our freshmen. I mean, it affects everybody. But at the same time, we look at it as, you know, what we're very much forward thinking and trying to figure out how we can move forward under the circumstances. And so we're actually going to have our virtual athletic banquet, I think, on May 18th. And we're going to make sure that we honor all of our student athletes, but particularly our seniors, and thank them for everything they've done in representing LIU.
Dr. Martinoff, you've worked at other universities in the area, so you have a pretty good idea of the collegiate sports landscape in the tri-state. I guess I got to ask you this. What made this the right time to launch the men's hockey program for LIU?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, we've had plans to add men's hockey. We work behind the scenes to try to prepare for it. Just like the other sports, we've added about, I think, 10 sports in the last 5 or 6 years to our athletic department. So that's part of our longer term plan. I think timing wise got to be very challenging under the circumstances of what's going on. Clearly, I think we were prepared, I think, in the early March to make an announcement. And obviously the COVID took precedence. You know, there was very much a need to be sensitive to the conditions. And I think as time went on, we realized that we still want to do this, and we had to make an announcement so we could get going. And so in an ideal world, it probably would have been an earlier March. That being said, life brings us changes and challenges. And so it got us to a point where we decided to make the announcement last week. And I think it's been a great thing for college hockey. As you can imagine, we got plenty of emails and phone calls and text messages which I don't know how people cell phones, like I text messages from people I never heard from. But I think it's great for college hockey. We have a great location to really put a stake in the ground, if you will, or a stake in the ice, if you will, to be that college team.
The athletic director of LIU, Dr. William Martinoff, joins us here, 98.7 ESPN. How long, because, I mean, hockey's a big program and certainly not a cheap program to run. How long has this been in the pipeline for? Obviously, this is not something that just started to be discussed recently. Does this go years back to launch a hockey program?
I don't know about years back. I think I should clarify. I've been the AD since July. But I've been at the university for 4 years. So I knew the years previous that we had longer-term plans to add sports along the way. I can't say specifically I knew about if it was there years ago, but I think in the last 6 months or so, we started thinking more about it and how we could make it happen. So I think, you know, you'll find that we're gonna add some more sports. We're going to do some great things on campus with facilities, and we're going to keep growing as an athletic department. I think it reflects our leadership of our president, Dr. Kimberly Klein, who's just a fantastic person in leadership and a big fan of athletics. I've worked with her 3 other times, and I've enjoyed learning from her and her vision of what it is to truly be exceptional in everything we do. And athletics is part of it, you know, and we're very fortunate to have her and her leadership.
Dr. Martinoff, what are some of the, I mean, and again, Dave kind of spoke to, you know, how big of an undertaking this is going to be. What are some of the, you know, the obstacles you guys are facing here trying to get this thing started up? And I mean, reading the announcement, it seems like they will play a schedule. This team will play a schedule in 2020, 2021.
Yes, that's the plan. So let me back up just a little bit, because I want to give our women's hockey coach, Rob Morgan, just a shout out, because he started the women's program just over a year ago, and he did a tremendous job. I think he had about 8 or 10 months before the September school start date. And he did a fantastic job of recruiting, built a program on a culture of success. And in his first year this past season, early March, first season, wins the conference championship in the New England Women's Hockey Association. So Coach Morgan has been very helpful for us to start, you know, building out more detailed plans for the men's program. So yes, to answer your question, we're going to play 2021 probably as an independent. I don't foresee that changing as an independent. And but when we do that, we realize it's a short timeline. But we're going to, you know, we're going to make it happen. We're going to play some games. We're going to recruit for the next year and build out the program just like Coach Morgan, 3-year timeline that he's had. And I tell you right now, he's ahead of it. He won for championship year one. So he's going to be very helpful, instrumental in us moving forward.
Dr. Martinoff, Rick DiPietro is always telling us about how good youth hockey is out there on Long Island. And I want to ask you this, how much does the prep hockey situation out there in Long Island influence you guys, factor into you deciding to green light the men's hockey program?
Oh, that's clearly a strong point, because the junior hockey leaguers, you know, they're looking for opportunity. What I found is that Long Island kids, you know, if they have a chance to compete at the top level and do it close to home or here, you know, somewhere in Long Island City, I mean, they eat it up. And I'll tell you right now, I've gotten emails from seniors already looking to enroll and be part of the team. I mean, since Thursday night at 4:30, I've probably got 5 to 10 student athletes emailing me directly. So there's a great deal. I think I use the term hunger for it, is that in this area, to be the only Division I college hockey program, men's and women's, I think allows us to really help our community, being that opportunity, that next level opportunity for kids to think about. I mean, to me, that's a great dream. Long Island kid playing hockey wants to come to LIU, play for the Sharks. I mean, that's a dream. That's the dream that's happening right now.
Dr. Martinoff, the athletic director of LIU, the Sharks on Long Island, of course, joins us here, 98.7 ESPN. All right, I got to get to it. Bear with me for a moment here. Coaching search. I'm sure that you're going to have people that are calling you and clamoring and want this. I have the coach for you right now. We can end this
I think I'm losing you. Wait, I think I'm losing you.
No, no, you're not. You're not. You have me perfectly.
Okay.
We have your future coach on the show right now. Number one draft pick in the NHL. Pipeline to youth hockey. Got his feet wet coaching Portland and led them to really unparalleled heights this season. We would like to offer you one, Rick DiPietro, to be the future coach. He wants the job. He's great with parents. He's great with kids. He's an innovator. He's desperate to do it. Please, let's get this done right now.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think there's no question that Rick has got a great basketball career, and I know he's coaching locally. We're actually kind of near the end of our search, but Rick, I'd be happy to talk to you offline, off the radio. But I think we're really close. We have some great candidates that are helping to build a program. So, Rick, if you want to call me later, we can chat and we can see what your interest is. I think we want to be able to name a coach soon and be able to do it so we can get on the recruiting trail, because that. The recruiting trail and the game schedule, are probably the two biggest things that we got to get moving on.
Do you envision there's any way that even though you're close to hiring a coach that he could talk to you socially distanced?
Yeah,
course.
You can call me right after this.
But wow you to the point that you're looking and you're saying, listen, the other guys, they just pale in comparison. I need to hire Rick immediately.
Hey, Rick, what do you think?
First and foremost, I want to say thank you, and I love what you're doing. I mean, this is a fight that I've been trying to fight over the last couple of years. Being able to now coach Portland and have the opportunity to be with these kids and be with these parents. You mentioned it. There is a ton of talent here, but the kids that are at that upper level, unfortunately, they don't have the opportunity to stay on Long Island, either having to go to prep school or the USHL. So to have the opportunity now to have Division I hockey, whatever I can do to help, I'd love to talk. I think this is going to be great, because from the time I got here almost 20 years ago, it's probably 20 years ago now, where hockey is, this used to be lacrosse. I mean, this was lacrosse. And now to see the amount of talent to, turn on the television and see, guys in the NHL that have played hockey at Portland and have played on Long Island, this is exactly what this area needs. So thank you and congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. It's an exciting time for the university. And I go back to my early days growing up in South Bend, Indiana, and I used to watch Lefty Smith coach the Notre Dame Irish and see how that program over the years built and grown, and now they have a new facility, 2 sheets of ice there, and it's just an awesome place to be. And so I know what it looked like back then with Lefty and what he was trying to do, and I think we have big visions in sight, and we're going to work towards them, and we're going to get somewhere where I think we're all going to be able to look back and be very proud of what we've done. And you said it, Rick. This is a great thing for our community, our area. And I'm just excited to be a part of it, to be quite honest.
Well, we do appreciate a couple minutes today. 101 this afternoon. Rick's going to call you.
Dr. Martinoff, I actually almost went to Notre Dame. I mean, it's funny that you brought up. I was looking back. Yeah, I saw that. I mean, where you're from and the jobs you had previous to come to LIU. I was legitimately probably, I don't know, a day or two away from committing to Notre Dame. I went down there with a couple of buddies that I played with at the U.S. program, the second you step on campus, I was like in mm-hmm. shock. It was amazing. But at that time, they didn't have their own facility yet. I mean,
what year was this?
I think my recruiting trip was in 99, so it was right around 2000, 99, 2000. So still Dave Poole was the head coach.
Yeah. So I was gone. So they were in the Joyce Center there, in the one side of the Joyce Center, and not a bad place, but not like the new one.
But no, the new one.
I just spoke to
Jeff probably a month or so ago, and what he's done with that program has been amazing.
Yeah, Rick has connections all over the place, Dr. Martinoff. He can speak to Jeff. He can speak to anybody that you're looking for him to speak to, and really bring in a high level prospect to the program.
Hey, Rick, don't you have an agent already?
I think he's looking for the job. I think Dave is officially taking over.
Oh boy!
So listen, we do appreciate it. Great success. We hope you have tremendous success. We'd love to have you on again at 101 today. Rick will be calling you, and we'll get that squared away.
Okay, that sounds great. Hey, guys, I really appreciate it. Like I said, it's an exciting time for LIU, and we appreciate you having me on and being able to tell us our story, and we look forward to talking with you again. Okay.
Yep. Thanks so much. We do appreciate a couple minutes.
So you're saying there's a chance?
Yeah. Oh, there's a chance. There's a chance.
No, you don't make the announcement. First of all, you don't make the announcement and plan, you know, and have the plan B, we're going to start immediately, if you don't have someone in mind.
I know exactly. I mean, you need to wow him. You need to say, I want the job. I'm the man for the job. And I am ready to start immediately.
Well, yeah, that goes without saying, of course.
You better call him at 101 today.
I don't know if I'm going to call. I mean, I would call
101.
Him the second.
If it gets to 105, you've missed your window.
You'll miss a place in line, Dave.
By 101. Division I'm one just hockey happy on Long Island.
Listen, I'm just happy, in all honesty. Would I love the job? Absolutely, 100%. I would do anything to help. I love the fact that this is actually happening. I mean, we've had conversations, what, a year ago? I mean, how long ago were we talking about how badly Long Island needs a Division I program?
It's great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been some time.
I mean, this is huge. I mean, the women's team was a success. I see them practicing all the time over at Syosset. And I mean, no kidding. He got a bunch of text messages and emails. My phone lit up. I got buddies here. I mean, you know, Pitbull, who works with me over at Portland, he sent me it. I got kids that I had coached sending me emails that are at different schools that want to transfer now and come here. That's a great opportunity, man. I went to BU because I'm from Boston. So now that I mean, grew up in Long Island, have a chance to play Division I hockey in Long Island. That's great.
Yeah, I have a hard time believing you're going to have a Division I men's hockey program in Long Island and you're not going to be involved in some way, shape, form, or fashion.
I do feel like I do a good job recruiting. I got to be honest.
Yeah,
I feel like that could be my strong suit.
You do a great job. I want you to get this job. I see no reason what would stand in the way, unless they actually have come to terms with someone. If it's still open ended, I feel good about your conversation with Dr. Martin later today.
You're hired, Dave. You're hired.
By the way, I mean, I talk about a hype man.
You are a great hype man.
I mean,
I take you in my corner any day of the week, buddy.
This is what we do. This is what we
do. It's an exciting time for hockey out there in Long Island, though, right?
I mean, yeah.
You got that program. You got the Islanders coming back soon.
Yeah. I mean, you got a new rink. Islanders getting a new rink. We'll see where LIU's going to play.
The greats from Long Island. Dinahan probably knows this, but the Ferraro brothers were some great Long Island players, right?
Yeah, they're still coaching. Yeah, Ferraro
Adam
brothers
Fox,
still around.
Obviously.
Adam Fox. You got Sonny Milano. Who else you got? You got Komisarek. You got Scuderi.
Wow. Imagine he kept
Scuderi's actually coach. Scuderi actually got a. Yeah, speaking of lucky, I mean, not lucky, he deserves it, but Scuderi, he got hired by Heinze over in Nashville. So he's in Nashville coaching now with the Predators. You got Jeremy Bracco, mm-hmm. plays in the AHL in Toronto system. He'd be a nice pickup for the Islanders. I had Jeremy Bracco when he was, I don't even know, Milo's age, maybe a little bit older, probably seven.
Really?
And he would shoot at my goalie camps. And my goalie camps were all the way up to 18 years old. And this kid, like, you could tell the second you saw him step on the ice that he was going to be a professional hockey player. He would come down. We'd have breakaway contests at the end of each day. And he'd be lighting up my, like, 16, 17, and 18-year-old goalies.
And he was how old?
He was, I don't know, 7, 6, 7, 8. I don't know, somewhere.
7 dominating 17-year-olds?
He was filthy.
Oh, my
filthy.
God.
Nasty. Like the one, like, I'm sure you see this with your kid. Like when you watch one kid play lacrosse, you're like, yep, he was born to play
that
lacrosse.
Kid's
this
got
kid
it,
was,
yeah.
Yeah, this kid was just like different.
Chris Higgins.
Yeah, Higgy.
That comes from Dinahan.
Nystrom. Jordy Hart. Dude, I'm telling you, I promise you, when I first got here 20 years ago, this was all I heard about was lacrosse. It was new to me because I mean, we had lacrosse team at St. Sebastian's, but I never played.
No,
it wasn't
a
huge
deal.
Long
Island's a different level.
Dude, I drove, so I lived in Oyster Bay. I drove down to town, and we grabbed a bite for lunch on a weekend, and we're walking down, and then all of a sudden there's traffic everywhere. And we kept walking, and it was this humongous lacrosse tournament. And I'm like, what's going on? He's like, oh, yeah, it's the guy explains to me how big lacrosse is in Long Island. And now, I mean, with how far hockey's come, I mean, how competitive these teams in Long Island are, how good these kids are, it's impressive.
Very impressive. All right, so we got that set up for you, 101 today. You'll disconnect from our program. And
I don't think he really wants me to call him, to be honest.
Oh, come on. Chris, he has to call, no?
No, I think he's expecting a phone call from
you.
I mean, they're establishing a Division I men's hockey program in Long Island. I mean, he's going to take your phone call.
If they hire, like, a big-time head coach, Would you take the job as the number one assistant?
Yeah.
You have
to call. Absolutely.
I would do it in a heartbeat.
I mean, what else did you want me to tell him? I mean, I would any way I can help, I would help.
Yeah, you know, you
exactly.
Of course, you have to call him.
All right, I'll call him.
All right.
A lot of pressure.
There's no pressure.
He's trying to get rid. You feel like you're trying to get rid of me. Like you want me off the show.
Only you would take it like that. Oh, really? Only you.
You want this to be CR.
How much do you love coaching Portlage hockey?
I love it.
Okay, and I see that
on
your
face
every day.
Power plays.
When I used to see you and see your beautiful face, every day you would Portlage hockey and the power play, and we would get into this deep conversation. So the fact that you could take what I'm doing here, as I'm trying to get rid of you, really is an issue with you. Because all I'm trying to do is help you and your coaching career to the next level.
You want me to be happy, and I appreciate
that. That's all I want.
Nothing makes me. I got off the phone. I talked to one of the GMs over in the USHL from one of my guys, because the USHL draft is coming up here, and we're going back and forth. And I said this, and I didn't even mean to say it. I just said it because I felt it. I actually get more enjoyment out of coaching than I ever did playing. I know that's crazy to say, but
I find it hard to believe, to be honest with you.
It's weird though, man. I'm telling you, maybe it's just the age group. There's something to be, I don't know. It's, you don't obviously have as much control, but the payoff, like when the team wins, or, you know, if you spent the whole week going over a certain faceoff play, and then in the middle of the game, you call the faceoff play and it works exactly like you coached it. It's like watching your kid do something. You know, when your kid does it, it's different than when you did it. You know what I'm saying?
Of course, of course.
There's like
it's
more joy.
It's better
that comes
when your kid does it.
Yeah, but it's like all of a sudden, you know, all these things that you practiced, and at the time, just think about how frustrating when you're trying to teach your kid something.
I have people from all over the place texting me, Long Island hockey guys. LaGreca's now texting Mike Komisarek. I mean, just not nonstop Long Island guys are being texted.
Yeah, Gilroy.
There's Matt
been a
Gilroy,
ton of them, man.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a hotbed, bro. But just think about that. Think of when you're trying to teach Ben or Alex something, and like the level of frustration sometimes because they're just not getting it. And then all of a sudden you go to one of Ben or Alex's games and all the things that you just spent how many hours practicing.
Yeah. It's the most gratifying thing ever.
Yes,
I would agree.
Exactly
would agree
right.
That.
That's how it feels.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I don't think this is right. Doug Wade is not a Long Island guy, is he?
No, he's on Long Island.
Yeah, but he's not from Long Island. Yeah.
No, he's I think he's Michigan. He went to Lake State. He had one of the funniest things of all time. We're sitting on the back of the bus. So his son Danny's really good. His son Danny is going to, I think, BC. I want to say okay. BC. He was out in the program with the U.S. national program. So we're sitting on the bus. This is years ago when Dougie was on the team with us. So he's in the back of the bus and he's reading an email and he's getting all frustrated. We're like, what's wrong? What's wrong with you? He's like, my wife just sent me a text. Danny's crying. Well, what's wrong? Why is he crying? Coach stole the stick, and he won't let him use the stick. And the only reason I gave him the stick is because he wasn't skating right. He was too upright, so I cut his stick shorter so it would force him to skate down. Coach doesn't know what he's doing. I'm going to send him an email. Like, you should send him an email. You're Doug Waite, man. I mean, there's a reason why you gave your kid. You know what size stick he should use. It's a certain height for a certain reason. So we got him all, like into a frenzy. So He gets on the email and he starts emailing the guy. He's like, how do you guys feel about this? It was like, dear whoever the coach's name was, there was a method to me having Danny use a shorter stick. I realized that it's a little short, but because he standed up, whatever he wrote, and he signed it, Doug Waite, 1,100 assists, whatever time on. Like, he put his whole resume after it and then said it was hilarious.
That's how you could have your signature when you're the head coach at LIU, the Sharks. Rick DiPietro, number one overall selection NHL draft.
I wouldn't, that's fine. I'd probably add a couple things to that, but that's okay.
Charlie McAvoy,
yep.
Right. Long Beach, I think, right?
Yes, sir. Long Beach.
I mean, there we go. The list goes on and
LIU,
on.
LIU, by the way, I mean, the colors they have too are beautiful colors. I mean, the things you could do with the jerseys and the swag. Huh.
Yeah.
You could be the Oregon of the East.
There you go. That's the slogan. When you talk
That's
to
nice,
Dr.
Right?
Martinoff at 101 today, we can be the Oregon of the East. Boom. Done.
Done.
He'll look nowhere else.
DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg. Weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.